talk about maximization of the end.
Okay, thank you very much. And thanks to the organizers for the invitation. So I want to talk about a joint work with Alexandru Nica and Dima Shlaktenko. And I want to start with some kind of motivation, what kinds of problem we are interested in. So let us assume we are given a big matrix, let's say n by n matrix, where n is very big, and then we decompose this matrix into 2 by 2 matrices of half the size, and we would like to ask questions. So if we know something about the matrix X, what can we say in a generic case about properties of the entries of this matrix, of this 2 by 2 matrix? Okay, so maybe one problem would be the following. So assume we know the eigenvalue distribution of the big matrix X, and then what is the best guess for the eigenvalue distribution of one of its entries, let's say X1, 1. For example, if we know that our matrix X has only eigenvalues plus and minus 1, let's say with equal probability, what is the best guess for the eigenvalue distribution of this corner, of this matrix? Okay, that's one problem, or maybe a little bit more complicated one is the following. Assume that we have a bit more information about the situation. So namely, assume that we also are able somehow to split our matrix X into these four matrices corresponding to the entries of this 2 by 2 matrix, and assume that we know the distribution of all these capital X matrices. So we know all expressions of the form, the trace of these n by n matrices, where we take arbitrary products of these matrices. Okay, and then again the question is, what is the best guess? So if that's all what we know, what should we guess for the joint distribution of the entries? So these small x's are now n over 2 by n over 2 matrices. So the joint distribution of this means that we would like to know all quantities of this from the trace of all possible products of these entries of our matrix. Okay, maybe to make it a little bit clearer what this means, what kind of information we have in this setting and what we are missing, is that one should note that this condition star, our knowledge on the product of the capital X's, means, of course, I mean, this product, of course, is zero in a lot of cases, because we have to multiply these matrices X in the right order so that always the non-vanishing entries get multiplied with each other. So only in special cases for the indices appearing there we get something non-trivial. So namely, of course, exactly it has to be as it is in the case for matrix multiplication. So the J index of the first matrix, so the second index of the first matrix, has to be the same as the first index of the next one, and so on. So we only get something non-trivial in this case, and in this case we get exactly the corresponding product of the entries. So what we know in this case is indeed what one might call the cyclic moments of the entries. Okay, but the question is, we want to know all moments. So the question is, what is the best guess for all moments if you know only the cyclic moments of a matrix? Okay, and of course, in a sense, these are problems of a more general type of problem. So namely, assume we have partial information about the distribution. So what is the best guess for the missing part of the information? And of course, it is clear, I mean, I have to be a little bit more precise. What I mean is a best guess. So I mean, and of course, my title shows you that I will use the entropy, free entropy, as a measure for the genericity of a distribution. So it will, of course, be some kind of maximization principle of free entropy under a given information. Okay, but intuitively, it's a question. I know part of the information, and I would like to fill in the remaining information. And what is, if I don't know anything else than the given information, what is the best or the generic choice for doing so? Okay. And so what I'm looking for essentially are maximization problems for free entropy, but this type of problems have a very nice structure, namely they can be treated very nicely in the context of operator value free probability. So this is really, this type of problem fits nicely in operator valued free probability theory. So maybe I should say a little bit more about this and show to you how this type of problem really has something to do with operator valued frames. So let me just recall what I mean with this. Okay, so we are working in a non-commutative probability space. So this means we have, let's say, von Neumann algebra, which usually has a trace. So it's a trace with von Neumann algebra M and a state on this. Okay, but in the operator-valued frame, we have in addition also a subalgebra B of M. And instead of working with respect to the state phi, we work with respect to a conditional expectation. So EB is a conditional expectation from M to the subalgebra B, which is compatible with the given state. And we are now looking on quantities with respect to this B. So B is now, in a sense, a replacement of the scalars. So we should think of B as scalars, but they are non-commuting in general. So elements of B do not commute, but we consider them as scalars. Okay, and if you have an element X in M, we address this as a B-valued random variable, and this means we are looking on its B-valued moment. So these are exactly this type of quantities. So that X is a B-valued random variable means that we exactly have this kind of information about X. Okay, so we are taking the expectation of product in X, but we also should put our scalars from B somewhere. Okay, because things do not commute, we have to put it at all possible places. So these B1 up to Bn are elements from B, and the B-valued moments of our random variables are exactly these expressions. Okay, and knowing all these expressions, in the case that phi is faithful, is the same as knowing all these expressions. So the main point is not that we are working with EB or with phi, but the point is that we are putting these elements B in between. Okay, and of course this means if we change B, so usually B is a fixed subalgebra, but of course in this context we can also consider the possibility of switching between different Bs. This means that in a sense we are changing the amount of information which we have about our random variable. Okay, and this is exactly what fits somehow with this. But before I come to this, maybe I should recall that of course in this operator valued context we also have the notion of freeness. So freeness is the main notion in free probability theory, and usually if one is in a scalar valued case, one has the usual freeness, but it extends without problems to the operator valued case. So we have freeness with amalgamation. The definition is exactly the same as in the scalar valued case, only phi is replaced by EB. Okay, so in such a context we are talking about freeness with amalgamation, and that's the main property of interest in free probability theory, and we know quite a lot. So we know a little. We know somehow how to deal with free random variables, even if they are free with amalgamation. Okay, but maybe now I should show you how this frame of operator valued probability theory, what this has to do with my starting examples of these random matrices. So namely, this is given the following way. So namely, we can now look at matrices of random variables. Okay, so we are looking at D by D matrices over a given probability space. So A psi is a given probability space, but we use the elements from A as entries for a D by D matrix. So we are building our new probability space M, which is just the tensor product of the D by D matrices with A, which means we are looking at elements X whose entries are elements from A. And of course we have a canonical state there, namely for the entries we have the state psi, and then for the D by D matrix we take the normalized trace. So we have the tensor product of the trace and the state psi. Okay, and in this context there are now different kind of subalgebras which are very canonical. So M are the D by D matrices over A, and of course the smallest subalgebra is C, of course, but there are also intermediate subalgebras. So a big one is B, which are just the constant matrices. So these are just the matrices with complex entries. So it's MD tensor I. And then more special subalgebra is given where we only consider diagonal constant matrices. So D consists of diagonal constant matrices and B consists of constant matrices. And M consists of random matrices, where the entries are random variables. Maybe classical random variables, or maybe just other non-commutative random variables. And of course, I have corresponding conditional expectations onto these subalgebras. Okay, and now, what does it now mean in this context to talk about elements in M as B-valued or D-valued random variables? This corresponds exactly to having different kind of information about the entries of the matrix. Okay, so what does it mean if I consider now the matrix? So X is now a matrix where the Xij are the entries, but if I talk about this as a C-valued distribution, then the only thing which I know are phi of Xn. This means I just know the distribution of X, but somehow I know nothing about its entries. So it doesn't matter that I have it given as a matrix. Okay, on the other side, if I talk about this as a B-valued random variable, this means I know its B-valued distribution. So this means I can multiply my matrix with all partial isometries, which allows me to single out all the entries of the matrix and to move it around in my matrix. And if I multiply all these things, I know exactly the joint distribution of all entries. Okay, so if I know it only as a C-valued distribution, I don't know that it is a matrix, or I have no information about its matrix entries, whereas if I talk about this as the B-valued distribution, then I really know everything about the joint distribution of the entries. And the intermediate step, so namely if I take D as a subalgebra and I consider X as a D-valued random variable, then I know the D-valued distribution, then again I have the freeness of multiplying my matrix with elements from D, but then I can only take the projections, which allows me to cut it into the pieces, but I'm not free to move the pieces around. So I really, if I multiply things, I really have only see things which come in the order as matrix multiplication goes. So this means I exactly know all cyclic moments of the entries of my matrix. Okay. So having X as a B-valued random variable means I know everything about the entries. Having it as a D-valued random variable means I know exactly all the cyclic moments. And now, of course, you see how the problem from the beginning fits in this frame, because knowing the cyclic moments of the matrix means I know its D-valued distribution. But what I want to know is its B-valued distribution. So it's really a problem of switching between different considering a random variable as on one side as a D-valued random variable, on the other side as a B-valued, and how can I come from one level to the other? Okay, so in some sense, I have different layers here, different levels. Of course, I also have C, and I can go from one to the other, and of course, the upper level determines the lower. So if I know it as a B-valued random variable, I have much more information than just knowing it as a D-valued. Okay. But what I want to do is essentially I assume I know the D-valued distribution, and then I want to know what is the best guess for the B-valued. So I want to make a generic guess for the B-valued distribution. And of course, there is where I need some notion of information or entropy for a measure of information or genericity. Okay, so maybe I should remind you now of these measures, which I will use in the following. And they were, of course, introduced by Voiculescu. So he introduced essentially two types of quantities in this context, namely analogs of the classical notions of entropy and of Fisher information. And all this takes place in a trivial von Neumann algebra space. And the first quantity is the free entropy, chi, which is defined very much in the spirit of Boltzmann, and I think you saw some concrete definitions about this in a talk of Kenley Jung. And the idea is essentially that, okay, so if you are given random variables somewhere in a non-commutative von Neumann algebra, so you are also given its distribution, then the entropy should be somehow the logarithm of the number of microstates which correspond to the macrostate given by the distribution of your random variables. Okay, a little bit more concrete. The microstates are given by matrices, so you are looking for how many possibilities do I have to approximate the given distribution of my random matrices by matrices. Okay, so I mean this is only the conceptual definition. The concrete definition is very technical, and there are a lot of limits which have to be done in the right order, and I mean there are a lot of technical problems with these quantities. But nevertheless, I mean it has produced a lot of spectacular results about von Neumann algebra. So even though that still has to be done on this kind of entropy. It's really a very useful quantity. And at least from a conceptual point of view, it's a very nice definition. Okay, but I want to talk more about the second approach somehow to this circle of ideas, which essentially relies on the other quantity from classical probability theory or statistics, namely the Fisher information. So Voiculescu also defined something which he called the free Fisher information, phi star, and in classical theory there's a relation between entropy and Fisher information, and we would expect the same relation between the free Fisher information and the free entropy, but unfortunately we are not able to show it. So what Voiculescu does is he defines a new quantity, a new Fisher information, a new entropy, chi star, which has exactly the right relation to phi star. And in the end, of course, we hope that this chi star should be the same as chi. But this is one of the big open problems in this field, whether these two things really are the same. But at least there has been a partial answer to this, namely by a recent work of Philippe Bianne, Capitaine, and Alice Guionet. It was shown that one is smaller than the other. Okay, but I mean, be aware that really solving it in full generality would imply very deep results. So, for example, if we would know that this is always the case, if we have equality of these two types of entropy, this would imply a positive solution to Kant's question whether every 2-1 factor can be embedded in the ultra power of the hyperfinite one. Okay, so this is really connected with very deep problems. So, I mean, all these things are not so easy. Okay, so but I want to use this free Fisher information, phi star, and the corresponding entropy chi star for dealing with these kind of maximization problems. And so maybe, okay, I should give you the definition of phi star, and maybe I want to motivate this a little bit from the classical theory. So I mean, the first definition of free entropy, this is somehow like in the spirit of this Boltzmann approach to the classical entropy. So you might ask, where you make some non-commutative replacement. Essentially, the microstates are now given by matrices. So it's clear that you have some non-commutativity around. So you might also ask, what is the motivation for the second definition of the Fisher information? Where does non-commutativity come into the play there? So maybe I should give you a motivation by reminding you a little bit how the classical Fisher information is given. I mean, Fisher information is a little bit more unclear from a conceptual point of view, maybe, so it's not so easy to motivate it. Let me first start with the formula, which maybe some of you have seen before, and of course, which doesn't tell you anything why this is commutative and how it could be replaced by something non-commutative. Okay, but the concrete formula for the classical Fisher information in the case of one variable is if you have a probability measure, the distribution of your random variable is given by a density p, then the Fisher information is given by this expression, which doesn't look very illuminating, but maybe you can reformulate this a little bit. Well, of course, you can also write it in this way, and then you see what you have there is the expectation of a random variable. It's the expectation of y squared, so it's the L2 norm, the square of the L2 norm of a random variable, and this random variable y is just a special function of your variable x, so it's p prime over p. Okay, again, p prime over p, it looks very special, so it's not clear what is the relevance of this. Okay, or maybe to some people it is clear, but nevertheless, let me point it out. So the Fisher information is the square of the L2 norm of a special function of your random variable, and this special function has a special significance, namely if we look what happens if I multiply this function under the expectation with some other function of x, okay, then you just work it out what it is, and then by partial integration you see that it has exactly the same effect up to a minus sign as taking the derivative. Okay, so this is just writing it down and using partial integration, and this means under the expectation this variable y, which is here given in this special form, but I mean the importance of y is that under the expectation it behaves in exactly the same way as taking the derivative of my function. Okay, so this means the Fisher information, the classical Fisher information, is the square of the L2 norm of a random variable y, which is a function of x, and which behaves under the expectation as a derivative with respect to x. Okay, and the derivative is now something which really can be made non-commutative. So namely, we say, okay, so the free Fisher information is exactly the same thing. We only replace the usual derivative by a non-commutative derivative. So what does this mean? So the transition from classical Fisher information to the free Fisher information is given by replacing the usual derivative by the non-commutative derivative. And what do I mean with non-commutative derivative? Well, so what is the effect of the usual derivative? Of course, you have, if you apply to x to the n, you have to erase all possible, take away 1x at all possible positions, and you can do this n times. But in the non-commutative world, you should remember the position where you have taken away the x, so you should put the tensor sign there. Okay, so what we do in the non-commutative world is if you take this non-commutative derivative, which I denote by del x, of xn, then, okay, we annihilate x at all positions, but we remember the position by putting a tensor sign where the annihilated x was before. So this derivative really goes from the polynomials in x into the tensor product of polynomials in x with polynomials of x. Okay, and then we just write down the corresponding definition for the free Fisher information by replacing this commutative derivative by this non-commutative one. Okay, so, and maybe up to now in this context I haven't mentioned a subalgebra, so this was essentially scalar valued, but of course in this context, if we are talking about derivatives, and we remember that if we have an additional subalgebra, we consider this as scalars, then it is clear that the derivative of our subalgebra should be a zero. So these are the constants. So if you put it in this picture, it's clear how this del x should act on them. So we can also write down directly the definition with respect to a subalgebra B. Okay, and that's the definition of Voiculescu. I only do it here for one random variable, but you can also do it for more. Then you have also partial derivatives. Okay, so we consider a random variable x, and we are in operator-valued frame, so we have a fixed subalgebra B, and then what I denoted by y before, so this was the special variable, so this is called the conjugate variable in this context. So this is a function of x, first condition, which behaves under the state in the same way as the non-commutative derivative. So the non-commutative derivative exactly does this sum, so it would put a tensor sign there, but then I take the state there, but of course because I'm in a tensor product I have to take phi tensor phi. So I have to take phi what was before the x times phi what was after the x, which I have annihilated. Okay, so these two conditions just say I'm looking for a random variable, a function of x and of b, which behaves under phi in the same way as this non-commutative derivative. And if such an element exists, it does need to exist, but if such an element exists, then the free Fisher information is the square of the L2 norm of this element. And if it doesn't exist, then I say the Fisher information is infinity. Okay, and this Fisher information should be a good measure of the amount of information which is contained in a B-value distribution of x. Okay. Yeah, okay, and now, so somehow we have put our problems in the frame of having partial information about the D-value information, and we are looking for the B-valued information, and we also have now a measure for the amount of information contained in such things, or measure for the genericity. So now we can go in the direction of asking what can we say about maximization theorems. Okay, and that's somehow the main result in this context. So namely, it tells us when essentially we don't gain any information if we go from the D level to the B level. I mean, that's somehow the idea. If you are given the information on a D level and you would like the most generic choice for the B level, you should choose a situation where you don't gain any information. Because this means, okay, any deviation from normality is information. Okay, but the most generic situation doesn't contain any information. So we should look for the situation that the free Fisher information on both levels are the same. And of course, I mean, it's very nicely that this situation can be characterized equivalently by a freeness condition. So freeness is really the nice notion which we have around. So we are in a situation that we have a von Neumann algebra M, and we have two subalgebras. So D is the small one, B is the bigger one. And we have this operator-valued frame. And unfortunately, we need a technical assumption, namely that the dimension of D has to be finite. I hope that this is also true in a general case, but we are not able to prove it in a general case. We really need this assumption. It's really crucial for our proof. We don't see how to get rid of it, that the dimension of D is finite. And then we really have this characterization that the entropy on both, that the free Fisher information on both levels, on the D level and the B level, is the same exactly if X is free from B with amalgamation over D. Okay, so in a sense, I mean, that also fits with this idea that freeness makes things very generic. So if things are free, you destroy essentially all information between them. Okay, but of course, so we would like to have X free from B, but because we have partial information, we cannot have it free just in a scalar-valued case, but we must respect the information which we have, so we can only have it free from B given the constraints which we have. So, but this translates here nicely into the language that it is free from B with amalgamation over D. So it's free from B with amalgamation over the information which we have. Okay, now we can translate this into the translation maximization problem. What does it mean for the maximization? So, and of course, I use now the entropy which goes with this phi star. So it's this entropy chi star. And so this essentially gives us a minimization for the free Fisher information, and this corresponds to a maximization of entropy. Okay, so Fisher information is information, so if things are generic, it's small, whereas entropy is the absence of information, so if things are generic, it is large. Okay, so let me translate this into the language of free entropy, and it tells us that, in this situation, if we are given the d-valued distribution of a random variable, then the entropy on the B level is maximal if and only if X is free from B with amalgamation over D. So this means a generic choice, if we are given the d-value distribution for the b-value distribution, is to make our random variable X free from B with amalgamation over D. Okay, so maybe a picture like this. So we are looking for the b-value distribution. So the green one, but we are only given part of the information. We are given only the blue information. We are only given the d-value distribution, and the question is how should we fill in the remaining information? And okay, the answer here is a generic choice. Generic choice is we should make X free from B over D. And really, if we know the d-value distribution and we know that X is free from B over D, this determines uniquely the b-value distribution. So these two bits of information are enough to determine the whole part of the information. So this is somehow the abstract solution to the problem for these maximization problems of free entropy, which can be formulated in this frame that we have different layers of subalgebras. So we know it on the D level and we want to know it on the B level. The answer is we should make X free from B over D. Of course, only if D is finite dimensional. Okay, but I hope it's also true more general. But maybe I should become a little bit more concrete. In particular, maybe if this notion of freeness with amalgamation, I mean, maybe this doesn't tell you so much. Maybe I should come a little bit back to the examples from the beginning where something more concrete can be said. I mean, this is the abstract formulation or solution of the problem. But what does it mean in the case which we had in the beginning? And this leads to something which we called acyclic matrices. So the situation in the beginning was that we had this matrices, D by D matrices, where the entries are random variables. So we had matrix X, which is given by Xij, and we considered, let's say, these two subalgebras. B are the constant matrices, and D are the constant diagonal matrices. Well, this corresponded to the problem that we prescribed the cyclic moments, and we would like to know all moments of the entries. Okay, and of course, here's the solution to the problem. But maybe in this case, we can translate everything from properties of the matrix. I mean, in this frame, everything is set in terms of the matrix X itself. But maybe it's more clearer or nicer to say it in terms of the entries. And in this case, everything can be translated in the entries. So namely, of course, knowing the D-value distribution of X is the same as knowing all cyclic moments of the matrix entries. That was what I explained in the beginning. Then furthermore, knowing the free Fisher information of X with respect to the matrices, so this is in this case B, is the same as knowing the Fisher information of all entries. Okay, so I mean, here you see here I have one random variable, but I consider it with respect to a subalgebra, but this is more or less the same as having all the entries itself. So instead of talking about X with respect to the constant matrices, this is the same as talking about the entries itself. And the entropies are the same. And, of course, the crucial thing is, what does it mean that I have this freeness condition? And this, we showed that this can also be formulated in a way which only includes the entries of the matrix. And it's a condition which is in terms of the free cumulants. So these things have appeared in some talks before. I mean, there was never a real definition, and I also will not give you a real definition of them, but maybe it's enough to say that the cumulants are multilinear functionals which are somehow calculated from the moments, and in many respects they behave much nicer than the moments, and a lot of things can be seen very clearly from them. And it's also this condition here, namely this freeness with amalgamation, corresponds to the fact that non-cyclic cumulants vanish. So I now consider cumulants where I have the entries of my matrix here. Okay, now the condition is, in most cases this is zero, and it only can be different from zero if I have exactly this matching here, which I had also before for the cyclic moments. So whenever it is not the case that this is the same as this, this is the same as this, this is the same as this index, then this thing has to be zero. Okay, so this is the condition that non-cyclic cumulants vanish. Okay, and this means, so I can translate everything which I have in this abstract frame in terms of the variable X, in this more concrete situation in terms of the entries of X, and the theorem in this context reads as follows. So namely, if I have a collection of random variables indexed by I and J, then the entropy of such random variables is maximal given the constraint that I fix the cyclic moments exactly if these elements are acyclic. So this means in this situation I am given the cyclic moments of my random variables, and the question is, how do I fill the remaining information? And the answer is, you should take random variables for which all non-cyclic cumulants vanish. Okay, so maybe my first guess, okay, you're given the cyclic moments, maybe you should set all non-cyclic moments equal to zero, but this doesn't make sense. I mean, that's not a positive distribution, that's not possible, but what you can do is to set all non-cyclic cumulants equal to zero. Okay, and this together determines the whole distribution. Okay, so this is the solution to problem number two, which I presented in the beginning. And of course, there's also problem one, maybe which is the most concrete one, which I should also say something about in the end. So that was the question, if I have my matrix, let's say a 2x2 matrix, X, or I have, let's say, a big matrix, and I write it as a 2x2 matrix, and I know the distribution of X. Let's say it has with equal probability eigenvalues plus and minus 1. And then the question is, what is my generic guess? How should I bet on the eigenvalue distribution of X11, for example? Okay, and this also fits in this frame. So, namely, what we are given, of course, is now the C-value distribution of X. So the generic choice coming from our general theorem, tells us that we should make X free from M2 over C. So here we even don't need amalgamation, so it's just the usual freeness. Okay, but this means that we can recover this X11 as the compression of the product of the matrix X and this projection, but because things are free, we have a very special situation which we can calculate, and it follows from an earlier work of mine with Andonica that the distribution of X11 is up to some rescaling the same as the free convolution of the distribution of X with itself. So in particular, if X has eigenvalues plus and only plus and minus 1, then the distribution of X11 is the convolution of free convolution of this with itself, which is the Arcsin law. Okay, so this means if I'm given a big matrix and I only know that the eigenvalues are plus and minus 1, and I believe in this free entropy maximization principle, then the best guess, the best bet for the distribution of X11 is the Arcsin law. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say. Maybe I also want to put down list of literature, so more or less things which I told you are contained in these three papers, joint papers with Andonica and Dima Schlagtenko. Okay, thank you very much.
I was wondering if in this free probability theory there was a notion of free relative entropy, because that's another way to get at the Fisher information that's quite natural and is done in other non-communicative contexts.
Yeah, so at the moment there is no general notion of free relative entropy. I mean, in a one-dimensional case, you can write down formulas. I mean, in a one-dimensional case, you have formulas and it's a logarithmic capacity, and I mean, then it reduces to known quantities. But in a general case, there is no, at the moment, no real notion of relative entropy.
There's also the possibility of going backwards from the Fisher information. If you, for Neumann algebras, if you you can define the Fisher information as the Hessian of a generalized free entropy. And your first formula where you had P prime squared over P, if those don't commute, there are many possible generalizations. And in some sense, the formula you wrote down with the derivative seems to me to look more like, not like the P prime over P squared one, which is the minimal one, but the maximal one that's associated with the Beer's metric. And I'm wondering if in principle you also have an infinite family here. And if you can go backwards to the relative entropy, which can be...
Yeah, I mean, what you can do is, in special cases, you can define relative entropies which corresponding somehow to putting things into a potential. So, and then you have an equilibrium distribution, and then you can define a relative entropy with respect to this.
Yeah. But
this.
I mean, it would seem natural to have a relative notion of...
In general, yeah.
Just simply for two distributions.
Yeah, but that we don't have. I mean, only in special situations.
The Fisher information could take you back to this, because it's possible to do that for these monochrome
and
monochrome.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. One question. Okay. Thank you once more. And we...